So we have 25 minutes of Q&A, and we would love it if you guys just threw out anything that you would like, because it really is a time to do that, and feel free. Okay? All right. And you can address either one, we'll come up.
How should I do it? Hi, I have a question, and it's just because I'm thinking of my story. And I'm wondering, are you the only child? Because you are, okay.
Yes.
Because sometimes we forget the other kids. Like, I don't know people for a long time in program, and I think they just have the one kid. And I tend to focus on the one kid. And I have three other great kids, so that was my question.
Yeah, I am the only child.
And thank you both for your story.
Thank you.
I have two sons, and one of them has a mother who's an athlete. Sorry, Basil. I have two sons, and one of them, my oldest, has a mother who's an addict, and a stepmom who's an alcoholic, and a father who is someone definitely needs to be in an Al-Anon room. So I guess what I'm looking for is, you know, what advice would you give to a parent with two kids that's definitely have parent that has parental backgrounds that make kids end up in the room with us?
Yeah.
That's you.
Great question. In case anyone missed it, what do I do when I get here, basically, and I've got kids out there? Or are both your kids using it as well?
No, they're okay. Young.
Just how do
young,
they?
And I guess I can't influence what they decide to do the rest of their life, but I'm raising two kids who definitely have addict parents and an Al-Anon father. And
okay.
Yeah.
So with Justin, I got him into Alateen really young. So he started really young. So he could create his own support group. And there are quite a few Al-Anon meetings that have it. I know it's struggling with the pandemic, but I know they still have it out in the valley. Dumet's, I'm pretty sure, still has it. That's on Friday nights. But the Alateen rooms make it so they can create their own space. You know, Justin was an Alateen before he got into AA. And a lot of kids will get in there and they get to say what they want to say about their parents. They don't have to censor themselves. So if you can give your child a space, from what I learned, to not censor themselves, then you're giving them a gift. It's the biggest gift that you can give them. If they come to you and they say, "Mommy wasn't great," don't say, "Oh, it's because Mommy's sick." Just let them know, "Okay, yeah, Mommy wasn't great." Like, identify for them that their emotions are real, because mine, with my mom always loving addicts, she would say, no, it's not like that. And it's like, but I'm right here, I'm not crazy. So whether I'm seeing it through the eyes of a 7-year-old or a 15-year-old, it still needs to be valid. So give your kids validation, because it's a mess. And reach out. There's a lot of parents.
I have a question, Justin.
Yeah?
Two kids I've used with my son, you know, he's now diagnosed with mental illness. Have you experienced that? He has psychosis when he's not using, and a lot of voices, and these people are, hacking him. With your drug use, did you experience that?
In my addiction, yes, absolutely. I don't have diagnosed mental illness, but I have it for sure, absolutely. There's been too many cases of suicidal thoughts, too many psychoses. I don't have a correct answer for how to deal with that. It can make this disease really complicated. But Yeah, I mean, I do have experience in it. This last time being out, not when I was going to get sober again, but now looking back reflectively, one of the scariest things about that is how far gone I had become in this, you know, fabricated version of myself. My mom can attest to it. I was completely lost. I was an absolutely different person, and I think a lot of that was due to, you know, amphetamine-induced psychosis. That's really the best answer I can give you. You know, I don't have a solution for it. You know, it comes and goes. I have days that are, you know, terrible in sobriety, depression, anxiety, whatever it is. It's a struggle, but you know. Just work on it and try to get through it and realize, like anything else, it'll pass. No.
Repeat the question.
Oh, her question was when the thoughts of smoking weed and drinking come into my head, do you think about essentially the consequences and how it's going to affect your loved ones? And my answer was no. That's what makes it that thought process so insidious, is you don't think about it. You know, it's just creeps in, you know. Like I said, I was on my way home from work, and I didn't even think about it. And I just went and picked up weed, like, after 5.5 years sober, like it was a normal thing to do when I get off work. So, yeah.
Justin, you said something that really stunned me. I've never heard it said. You said, I forgot where all these blessings came from. Could you expound upon that? Like, they disappear, or they haunt you, or did you coming back and feel guilty? What happened when you forgot all the good stuff?
That's a great question. I think, you know, I don't think I'll ever understand the psychology of the disease of alcoholism. I don't fully understand it. I don't think anybody really does. But I think that it relates to that same insidious thought of like, oh, I can smoke weed and drink. So they call it like prelapse, but. For me, it really starts with negative thinking, and if I don't have, like I said, those support walls of the program around me, people to call, or like the reaction to call people when I start thinking, having stinking thinking, they call it, then those negative thoughts compound on each other, and my whole worldview becomes extremely negative. So once that gets worse and worse, I get to a point where it's not that I necessarily like consciously want to get high, it's more of a why not? Like my perception is already very negative, so like why wouldn't I be getting high? There's no reason to be sober, if that makes any sense, you know. But it's sneaky. It's the disease is very weird, you know. Very strange. I love but my favorite description word in the book is cunning. That is the disease right there. So yeah, I hope that answers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have an 18-year-old daughter, mm-hmm. who's moved away, and she's depressed, anxiety, and she wants a psychiatrist is giving her drugs to live. I don't know how to make a connection with her. The closer I try, the more she runs. How do I connect?
Unless you're willing to get loaded with her, it's not going to happen. I hate to say that, but it's true. I used to fantasize about that with my dad with 35 years sober, that he would relapse with me. That sounds sick, but when you're in the disease, that's the only way to relate, is you got to be doing what I'm doing, or at least thinking the way I'm thinking. I wish there was a little bit more hope in that, but, you know.
I have one thing.
Go ahead.
I have one thing to say on that. Make the connection for yourself, not for her. Send a text that says, I love you. Don't expect a response. Just let her know. If you can reach out for yourself and not for them with an expectation, you'll be okay.
There's some hope.
Question or whatever for both of you, two different perspectives, but you know, I have a daughter, she's 4.5, five or so, so many months sober or whatever, and you know, she's in that spot where she knows that she wants to be sober, but she doesn't want to give up drugs, so now she's like, she's really struggling with, I'm just going to go smoke and drink. And, you know, she kind of wants to do it, but she also knows where it's going to go, but she doesn't want to admit it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm just being her dad, watching the process, and I just want to see if you have any comments, advice. You would know her perspective better than me, and Jody, you would know my perspective better than just. So if you both want to say something, that would be great.
The best thing that I can say about that, I was just talking to somebody about this the other day, is two things. One, that's, from my perspective, that's a bummer, you know, because that's how it starts. But the other thing is, and there is a little bit of hope in this, is I was talking to my friend about this who had about 7 years sober when I had five, and we have been using together. When we went out, we used together, so he lost a lot of time too. And we were talking about how I really feel bad for people that are trying to get sober that haven't experienced sobriety, haven't experienced the freedoms that come from long-term sobriety. It took me originally about a year and a half to really realize, like, oh my Lord, like, I can exist on this planet and have freedom and do whatever I want. When I'm loaded, I can't do anything. I got blinders on like this. All I can do is get high. That's it. You know, get high, theft, and violence. That's pretty much it, you know. But when you're sober, you're, the world is your oyster. When you're trying to get that your first time, there's a lot. I can just tell you based on my experience, one, there's a huge part of you that doesn't believe it's going to work, right? No matter what you do, do what everybody says you're supposed to do, it's not going to work for me. And then the other part is not deserving it. And then the last aspect is it even worth it?
Precisely.
So.
Those three things, she experiences those three things precisely.
Yeah, it's a really tough place to be in until you get to that point of, you know, experiencing what sobriety can offer. It's very, very difficult. And it comes different at different times for everybody, so. Absolutely.
So as a parent of and watching him go in and out of it, I think he mentioned one time he's been in and out of rehabs, whatever, like 18 times, you know. I can't even imagine how exhausted I would be if I was literally on that roller coaster with him every single time. So to hear that there's a line she has to cross over for herself, I think is a really important message. I can't push anyone over a line for themselves. I can't make them go over the threshold. I can just be there. I can just be there. And that doesn't mean be there to fix it. It just means be there to love. Just love. And I have seen my kid in some really bad situations. And I just got to look at him, take him out for lunch, and take him to the movies. As scary as he looked to other people, I got to have compassion. I got to see him as a human being. The other thing my kid taught me, I never walk by a homeless person if I have money in my pocket and don't give it. I don't care what anyone says. Oh, they're just going to go use. It's not my problem. I had a woman come up to me one time, and this is what it feels like as a parent. She walked up to me, and my kid was using, and she was pregnant, and I knew she was going to ask me. She was all strung out. And she came up. I didn't have any. I had $20. And I gave her the $20, and she's like, oh, my God, thank you so much. And I said, no, thank you. My kid's out there, too. And she started to cry. You know, everybody feels. Your daughter feels. She feels a lot. And all we get to do is love them. Can't fix them. Just be there.
My daughter lives with me. She's 20, so an adult, but, you know, going to school, or she goes to school. She may not be passing school, but she's going to college. One day at a time, right? My question is, there are days where she literally, like, can't get out of bed. And so I'm at work, and I'm doing my thing, and I haven't heard from her. I haven't gotten the text that she's on her way to school because she doesn't drive, so she takes Lyft, and I'm a mom, and so I make her at least send me the information, so God forbid something happens, I have to start, and so I don't get anything. So I text her, you know, hey, are you going to school today? And I don't get a response. So then I'm like, the whole ride home from work, I'm wondering, what am I going to be walking into? Is it that she's just asleep, or has something more seriously happened? So I'm wondering, from your perspective, is there anything more that I can do as a parent just to, you know, keep the lines of communication open? One of the things I learned to do with my daughter is back up. And the more I backed up, the more she came to me. So I'm really trying to do that detachment thing. It's a very hard dance for me to do, but, you know, we're working on that. And then as a parent, like, how do you handle, like, I mean, I haven't had the situation yet, like what you've gone through, but I still have the fears. So what can you guys give me?
Yeah, well, because I'm not a parent myself, I don't have the best answer for that. I can look back at my life and say, well, my parents could have done this, or they could have done that, or they could have done this. But the reality is my parents did the absolute best they could with what the cards they were dealt, and I'm grateful for it. Why? Because I am who I am today, right? Like, there's nothing more or less they could have done at all, you know? But my mom does describe it best when she says she gave me, you know, I told her, you know, you gave me the dignity to choose my own path. And don't get me wrong, I hated her and my mother hated her and my father in multiple situations. One specifically, I came to my dad's in a wheelchair and I was cold and I asked for a blanket and he said, get the fuck off my property. And I hated him for it. And my mom, you know, multiple situations very similar like that. But then later on in sobriety, that specific event may have saved my life. And I can recognize that, you know, or, you know, whatever situations my mom may have put me through in the same deal. So, yeah.
Like Justin gets to be funny sometimes, so do I. It sucks when you live with it. When it's in your face, I remember one time coming to the front door. I couldn't find Justin in the house. And I came to the front door. I opened the door. And I probably have this wrong because I don't know all the drug lingo. And he's like, I don't know, he's got a spoon and he's got liquid and he's going to do whatever he's going to do. And I just shut the door. I just shut the door. And he's on the front porch and I'm just like, huh. What do I do, right? And I said, you can't live here anymore. That's it. My kid hasn't lived with me since he was 17. I said, you can't get a year of sobriety, you don't get to live at home. And he couldn't string a year of sobriety together till he was 20 years old. And by then, he could figure out how to get on his own and support himself. I'm not saying you should do anything that anyone else does with their kid. I don't say that to anybody. We all find our path. I can't live with the disease. That's me personally, because I will thrash you. I just talk about insidious, I will thrash because I feel so out of control. So to me, if your kid goes to school, she goes to school. If she doesn't, she pays consequences for it. You know, if she can't figure out how to get there, she can't figure out how to get there. So it's a lot of that let go, but in honesty, it is very difficult when you live under the same roof. And that's why I knew I couldn't. I've never even lived under the same roof with Justin while he was getting sober. I can't do that either. I'm sorry, I love a lot of alcoholics, but I don't want to be around them when they're getting sober.
I have a quick question too. You mentioned that be careful of following other people's sobriety or other people's recovery than finding your own path. How do you know when you start following somebody else's than trying to find your own?
That's a really good question. I don't know if that specifically is super common for a lot of people. With me, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I grew up in the rooms and I grew up around my dad, who has his sobriety and his specific way of doing things. And because of that, you know, I go into the rooms in my area and he's talked about constantly by everybody. So it's like this, almost like a subconscious, like I'm in his shadow no matter what I do. So it was hard for me to find my own path in recovery, right? But how do you know? I mean, I don't know. It's a hard question to answer, you know. But I can tell you what I did, and it was clear for me when I was on my own path, is when I got sober and stayed sober for 5 years, I got a sponsor that didn't know my dad, didn't do the steps like my dad at all. And I completely had an individual experience through the steps, specifically. Don't get me wrong, I'm still at meetings where he was at and stuff like that, but I think what's important is making sure that you have your own personal experience walking through the step work. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, that's where I can answer that.
Hi, Justin.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a 16 and a half year old son. Almost 17, he's in 11th grade. He started vaping marijuana and doing all sorts of things with like 12 or 13.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd only been in rehab once for 30 days about a year and a half ago. But I mean, and he's using marijuana every day, so he's saying he's not. Mm-hmm. So we're on this journey like your mom has been on, just letting go, letting grow, just learning how to love you, just however you are, accepting life on life's terms. And one of the things that I learned is that, you know, my dreams are not my son's dreams.
Correct.
Because we grew up and we have dreams for our children. From baby, we have a dream for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tried to mold them into school and sports.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my wife, go to church, you know. But we really had to realize, you know, his dream is not our dream. And I was just wondering, though, do you have dreams, like short-term, long-term dreams? What would they be? Can you share a couple of dreams you might have for your future?
Sure. I got to give you a little background. So my mother always encouraged anything that I wanted to do, other than drugs, of course. But, you know, and I love that. Where my father is a little bit different. I don't want to say it's his fault. It's just kind of the way his brain works. Anytime I had a dream, his reaction would be, well, you know, this could happen, right? From a very young age. So my dreams from a young age and my dreams now are kind of simple. I would like to be financially free, not have to worry about money. And I would like to help as many people as I possibly can in whatever way that is. And I'd like to be a husband and a father. Those are my dreams, you know.
I wish you luck in your journey.
Thank you.
Could you both mention something about your fourth and fifth step and how that helped and where it led you?
Which one?
Fourth instance.
Yeah, which one of them? I've done about, I don't know,
he's
12.
Done many times.
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, she asked if we could share our experience on the fourth and fifth step. I've had varying experiences on the fifth step. The fourth, they all suck. I've heard from a lot of people like, oh, the fourth step shouldn't suck. Like, you're just going through your life. It sucks. I hate it. I absolutely hate it. It's a little bit too educational for me. I've never really liked school. I never liked writing and it just feels like I'm doing a homework assignment. I don't like that feeling. Fifth step, though, I've had the first time I did a fifth step, I didn't disclose every secret that I've ever had because I didn't think it was necessary, and it bit me in the ass. And then the second fifth step, I disclosed everything, and it was extremely uncomfortable, and I thought I was in a lot of fear of judgment. And the craziest thing happened. My sponsor goes, oh, I did the same thing. And I was like, what? You know, no way. So that was really freeing. And then I don't know if it was the one after that or the one after that, but I had an experience of feeling terrible. Something about vocalizing these resentments that I had towards people to another person really made me realize, like, the type of person that I was, you know? That one was in sobriety. I was 3.5 years sober, decided to go through the steps again. And in that situation, there's no drugs and alcohol to use as an excuse for my behavior. So when you're sober and you got this long list of people you hate for the dumbest reasons ever, it's hard to look at, you know? So, yeah, that's been my experience on fourth and fifth.
So I'll just put out a quick one. The first time I did my fourth step with my sponsor, she was great. I picked a sponsor that was actually a stand-up comedian. And so she said to me, because I didn't know laughter, and I hated that all the alcoholics were laughing, even in sobriety. So I was like, I'm going to get this. Right? So she said, I want you to do your fourth step and I want you to write it out on one page. And I was young, I was 25 when I got in these rooms, and I was like, oh, she thinks I'm not good enough, I'm not going to do this right, you know, I'm not as good as her other sponsees. And then she said, and then when you get it written, I want you to call me and read it to me. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm not even good enough to do it face to face. And so I did what I was told. So I call her up, I wrote it out just on one page, you know, 8.5 by 11. I read it to her. She said, now I want you to go into the bathroom and I want you to rip it into little pieces. I want you to put the phone on the counter and I want you to pee on it, and then I want you to flush it. And I was like, okay, so I do exactly what she says, toilet flushes, I pick up the phone, she goes, now you understand why I didn't need to watch you pee, and you don't want more than one page? Because you're going to clog the toilet. You have the rest of your life, if you choose to stay in these rooms, to do as many steps as you need to, as many times as you need to. Our life is forever changing. We're in it, and it's fluid all the time. I do four steps every day. I break the steps down in 60 seconds. I do it with my sponsees all the time. You take a problem and you ask yourself, what do I do with this? Do I have power over it? More than likely not. Will I lose my emotional sobriety? Sure, I can if I do my old behavior patterns. Or I keep my sobriety because I choose to pick up the phone and call my sponsor or do something different. Two, is there a power greater than me? I don't care what you make that power. It doesn't have to be outside of you. It can be inside of you. Just make sure it's a greater good of what you're thinking in that moment. Step three, are you willing to give that craziness over to that greater good? Sure, because I'm obviously in enough distress that I'm going to be here in this moment. four. What's my inventory? My inventory is I was going back into an old behavior pattern. Am I willing to share that with somebody else, even if that old behavior pattern is scary? Sure, that's why I have a sponsor or sisters in this program or men that are my great friends in this program. And that's who I share it with. Six, is that old behavior pattern worth keeping anymore? Does it serve me? Does it have a purpose in my life anymore? Seven, realize no and give it away. It doesn't mean it was bad, because it did serve a purpose at one time. It just doesn't serve any purpose now. And seven, turn it over. Eight, a list of people I've harmed. That's easy, because if I haven't lashed out yet, it's only me. I am the only one on that list. Nine, my letter of amends is always a letter of gratitude. And if it's me, I'm gonna write it to myself. Hey, Jody, you've got this. You're okay. You're gonna do this. You can do this. You have done this. And then 10, my immediate amends just happened. That's work in the steps. 11, sought through prayer and meditation. What is my prayer and meditation? It's the pause. It's that inhale, hold it. Exhale, hold it. Pause. Be in the pause. Life will keep going. If I say one more thing, it's not going to change it. It's going to keep going. So stay in the pause. And then 12, what's the spiritual awakening? I did it different. I showed up differently for myself. That's it. There's no burning bush. Not for me, anyway. Showing up differently, changing my narrative, whether it's my past or the worry about my future.